Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, thank you so much for tuning in to this week's Food for Thought, a podcast on a mission to equip you all with the latest evidence-based advice that you need to live and breathe a healthy lifestyle. I'm Rhiannon Lambert, registered nutritionist, best-selling author of Renourish, A Simple Way to Eat Well, soon to be author of The Science of Nutrition out December the 30th, 2021, and founder of Retrition, London's leading private nutrition clinic. In each episode, we are going to be joined by guests, all of whom are experts in their field, so that together we can all learn fact from fiction and empower the healthiest and happiest versions of ourselves with our trusted expert advice. The relationship that we have with food can be complex and in many cases, much more so than you realise, and I really do believe that food should be seen as a source of enjoyment and nourishment, but the truth is, sadly, that it's just not that simple. And this week's Food for Thought sees one of Retrition's very own registered dietitians, Sarah Elder, and I delve into the complexities of disordered eating and how you can improve your relationship with food. Hello, Sarah.
Hi.
It's a bit strange for us to be, I guess it's nice and a strange different thing for us because obviously we work together in the Retrition Clinic, but we don't often get the chance to have a chat like this, do we, for a whole hour on eating disorders?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think it's something that obviously will be really important for our listeners because I think a lot of the time it's very hard, isn't it, to know if you have a good or bad relationship with food because it's not like there's a lot of guidance out there.
Yeah, and I think it's so difficult because in terms of the guidance that is out there, there seems to be lots of information about kind of eating disorders, but a little bit less information about people that might, or how to get help and support if you've got a disordered relationship with food. And I think everyone's relationship is so unique with food and it kind of comes from our life experiences. And it's so difficult to kind of think about, oh, well, actually, have I got a good relationship with food? Have I got a bad relationship with food? And it's really important that we actually take some time to think about that. Because if your relationship with food is taking over your whole day and you're starting to kind of worry about things of what you can and what you can't eat, if you're getting anxiety around food choices, of what food you can have, what your food you can't have, if you're spending loads of time thinking about what you're going to have for your next meal, what other people have been having, are you making right food choices or spending lots of money on that as well, the chances are actually that relationship might be quite a negative one. And I think that we need to be aware of that because if it's having a really big impact on your life and having such a negative impact and taking up a lot of space within your life, then we kind of need to think about, right, well, how can that be a little bit better?
Yeah, 100%. And what would you say then? So I guess the ultimate question is, what is the difference for everyone listening between a disordered relationship with food and an eating disorder?
Yeah. And I think if we kind of think about relationships with food almost on that spectrum, we've kind of got a spectrum that's from what people would kind of class as that normal eating for them and that family situation that they're in, that social situation that they're in. We then, it comes onto that disordered eating pattern and then eating disorders. And what we need to think about is, well, what is a clinically diagnosed eating disorder? And what we tend to use within kind of the clinical setting and within the NHS is our DSM-5 or our ICD-10 criteria. And that's to diagnose things like anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, binge eating disorder, ARFID, OSFED, and diagnose those clinical diagnoses of an eating disorder. However, we've got this middle part of that kind of spectrum, really, where people have a very disordered relationship with food. And it's when we're thinking about that, how to distinguish that. Disordered eating is defined as that abnormal eating behaviour away from the social and that cultural norm. And that can include any kind of fad dieting, attempts to kind of eat clean, over-exercise, or use other very negative behaviours that might be used to kind of influence food choices. So people might do things such as purge or take laxatives as a way to control their kind of intake. And we do know that a lot of the population could be considered to have that disordered relationship with food, because they might be avoiding food groups, they might be skipping breakfast, they might be following those kind of fad diets that we see. But it's the impact that has on someone's day-to-day life. And if they're denying their kind of their hunger signals, if they are becoming quite socially isolated and withdrawn because of the food choices that they're making doesn't allow them to go meet up with friends and do the fun things that they want to do, and if maybe they are feeling a lot of anxiety and guilt around meals, that's when we need to start to think, okay, there's some red flags here. This could be some disordered eating, because it's affecting and infiltrating quite a lot of parts of someone's life.
Yeah, 100%, because it's so difficult as well as a health professional, I think, because you don't want to categorise somebody, and sometimes labelling can be harmful, but there's also a need to a degree, isn't there, to decipher what you've just said in order to get the help that people need. So in terms of who is going to make this diagnosis, if you could share, who should somebody go to in order to discover this? And does there tend to be a trend, do you think, to people that you find are slightly more susceptible to this form of disordered eating? So I guess there's two questions there.
So I guess that first question about diagnosis, and I think you're right. I think sometimes having that label on your food choices can be very difficult in kind of making a label in terms of, do I have disordered eating? Do I have an eating disorder? Do I have a difficult relationship with food? I think for some people it can be very helpful, and for other people it's not so helpful. And I think we have to work with people to kind of identify, is it going to be helpful to have that diagnosis or not? But if you are suffering and you feel that this is kind of a disordered eating, and you're worried, is this developing into an eating disorder, then you would need to go to your GP and speak with them and ask for some support and have a discussion around what and how those thoughts are affecting your day-to-day life. And it's generally kind of a mental health team that would then be able to diagnose a clinical eating disorder, and they would use that DSM-5 or ICD-10 criteria. And I guess in terms of if there's a trend, kind of, or if there tends to be kind of a trend towards someone who's sort of more susceptible to develop disordered eating, was that the second question?
Is there a type that you see, a more susceptible type?
I mean, I think what we kind of know is that anyone unfortunately has a risk of developing disordered eating patterns, and that can come from kind of you could develop that because someone might be using those disordered kind of eating relationships to distract them from what's happening elsewhere within their life. They might be using that as a comfort. But there seems to be quite a lot of research around clinical diagnoses of eating disorders. But when we're thinking about disordered eating, it's much more difficult to kind of get numbers and find out actually, well, who is going to be more susceptible, I guess, to developing this disordered eating. But what we do know is that when we think about people who have developed very difficult relationships with food, they might have had quite a lot of high exposure to the media who are kind of promoting certain food types, or they might have perceived pressures to look a certain body way. There might be genetics with kind of within their family. There might be a history of people that have had disordered eating, or sometimes certain personality traits as well. So perfectionism and impulsivity, people with those kind of personality types might be more susceptible to developing disordered eating, which could then go on to an eating disorder and being diagnosed with that.
Yeah, and I guess there's just there are so many factors, I suppose, to address on this question. And I think we should touch on the fact that the last year, or the unprecedented times with the pandemic, has seen cases of eating disorders skyrocket. And I know you joined our team in the last year, and the demand has just been completely overwhelming. So do you think that the culture and the combination of COVID has really, it is to blame for this rise in numbers?
I mean, when we kind of, you're exactly right what you said there in terms of the number of people that have come forward and said, I need some help and I need support with my disordered relationship with food, or they feel that they might have a diagnosed eating disorder. That has really risen in the last year, and there's lots of NHS services, private services that are out there helping so many people, and so many more people than maybe we've seen before. And I guess what we can kind of think about in terms of that pandemic that we've had, it's caused a lot of change within people's lives. And one of the things that we do know that kind of happened during COVID is that people lost some of those social connections. We were isolating, we were kind of in our houses, we had lockdowns. And so what our normal social interactions of meeting people outside, going into work and meeting friends and family, that very much suddenly became an online social connection. And things such as enjoyable activities, those social contacts, meeting up with friends, developing new social networks, that was all done virtually. And the difficulty was at that time as well that we kind of found that there was lots of messages and lots of things within social media that could be quite triggering and quite difficult for people who might have already had a little bit of a difficult relationship with food. And we saw quite an increase of things like cook-alongs. We saw lots of an increase of online exercise classes. There was loads of stuff, wasn't there, all over the news about telling people that they needed to go for a certain number of walks per day.
Oh my goodness,
yeah. There was so much, so many things. And I think if you've already got a very difficult relationship with food and maybe with your body as well, then all of these messages suddenly are coming through different media channels. And I think, I don't know the stats on this, but I do know there was a huge rise in people using social media at that time.
Oh, it was huge. I noticed it. I could not get over it. And I was pregnant. I remember it was just huge, skyrocketed.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the trouble with a lot of those algorithms that were on social media at that time is if you looked at one thing, it would bring a cascade of other things which might have been really unhelpful situations. Whereas maybe that if you'd seen something or someone had spoken about a diet or something that had maybe been quite unhelpful, that you would have had really good social connections and discussed that with people. However, people were quite isolated during that time. So there wasn't someone else to have that discussion with. So a lot of these messages kind of almost became quite gospel. But also what we know is there was a lot of uncertainty at that time, and there was a lot of stress, a lot of anxiety. And what we know is that when people can feel quite stressed and quite worried, and there's lots of feelings of uncertainty, we look for, as humans, to actually control something and to think, okay, something's going well. And for some people, unfortunately, during kind of COVID and during lockdown, they went towards food to try and control that, because that felt that that was something that maybe they could manage and that they could control a little bit, when everything else felt so uncertain. So those two things kind of coupled together, there's no wonder we kind of saw that rise in people's kind of relationships with food, actually. The difficulties and the disordered kind of eating patterns, and people actually reaching out for help and saying, do you know what, I need some support with this, because this is now impacting upon every part of my life now.
It just makes me so sad, because it's so blatantly obvious when you describe it like that. And I think it was almost completely overlooked by the government at the time as well, the mental health impact originally that this was having on everybody. And you're right, the messaging in the media at the time was very much, oh, you need to lose weight, you can't. It was a lot of discussion around weight, around very weight-centric, talking about risk of COVID. And people were probably equally scared as well of catching COVID. And just so many things, but social media in particular, if we just delve into social media a little bit more, I think it creates completely unrealistic expectations and exacerbated things beyond measure, because like you said, there's an algorithm. And of course, if you follow, I don't know, a foodie account like mine, for instance, with recipes on it, you might be exposed to so many foodie accounts that aren't by nutritionists or people that have an understanding, but with really restrictive information, I suppose, you'd suddenly get bombarded with maybe a juice detox page or something.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's that difficulty, because we have, and we all know in theory that actually social media is a snapshot of someone's day, and that that is a very kind of, it's maybe 5 minutes on someone's stories of their day or less sometimes. And people might want to show kind of the best bits of their day, which there's nothing wrong with at all. But if what you're seeing, the best bits of someone's day, and your day is not going so well, that can be really hard to see. So I think it's really important that actually within kind of social media that we're being quite transparent, that not everything is brilliant all of the time, and that people are struggling, and to be able to acknowledge that. And I think one of the things that I guess we've seen quite a lot, and I don't know whether this went up or went down or stayed the same kind of within kind of COVID, but I know that it's definitely become more popular over the years is that kind of those pictures of what I eat in a day and those kind of social media posts. And it's so hard. And that in itself is an unrealistic expectation. One person is sharing what they eat, which might be filtered, it might be unfiltered. Yeah. You just don't know whether that's
actually... If they even did eat it. They probably, you know, absolutely. A lot of the time it's just compiled to look perfect. Nobody has the time. It takes me so long. If I'm going to produce content, it's hours. You don't just produce pretty pictures in a snapshot and then consume it straight away.
Absolutely. And it is that false illusion in terms of what people are saying that they're kind of eating within a day. And I think that in itself very much gives it unrealistic expectation, because even if that person has eaten that, then that's what their body needs at that time. And there's so many factors among that. And they might have certain allergies. They might have certain medical conditions that they need to follow certain kind of, a certain medical diet because of maybe a certain medical condition. Mm. And it's so difficult. And that in itself really causes kind of a lot of anxiety with a lot of people that I work with, because they're kind of saying, well, that person's able to eat this in a day. And if I eat that in a day, then maybe I will have that life and what that person has. But it's just, it's not like that. And it's so difficult to be able to kind of identify what is real and what's not real on social media sometimes. And it's not just about what people are eating in a day, but then you've got these social media experts, these so-called experts as well. And I'm sure kind of we've both come across them so many times in terms of saying and giving out this advice that just isn't correct around either nutrition. Sometimes you see it around medical advice as well.
Oh, shocking, I know.
Yeah, it's terrible. And you just think that, well, these people haven't got a qualification that gives them the right to be able to give this advice, but also what they might be advising might be totally unrealistic, but also just not true, and there's no evidence behind it. So if you're filling your social media feed with things such as what people kind of are eating in a day, what different so-called, I guess, experts are advising, it must be so confusing to think, well, what should I be having for me? What is going to help me meet my kind of optimal health? What's going to help me meet my goals? And it must be so confusing. And I think that there's so many things that are out there that offer these quick fixes to kind of improve people's health. And we saw that quite a lot over COVID. I don't know if you'd kind of noticed that, but there was lots of adverts for sort of herbal remedies and... Gosh. Yeah,
and I mean, I was in the newborn bubble just after April, but I remembered, you know, I was constantly getting media requests about vitamin C pills and people wanting to know what food would be good to fight COVID. I remember that very clearly.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that at that time, it's that scaremongering saying, actually, do you know what? We've got a magic fix here. And if you're able to have this food, then you will be able to kind of beat COVID as such. And they were the kind of messages that we were seeing a lot, and we're seeing that far too much at the moment. And I actually thought that, oh, do you know what? Things are getting better. But all I'd actually done is I've cultivated my feed on social media so that I'm just seeing all of the experts.
Of course.
But all of that stuff is still out there. And I think especially those discovery pages on a lot of the social media, that's where these unhelpful messages start to come in. And it's so difficult for people to be able to navigate through that.
And do you find in the clinic that because of all of this, obviously we're talking about eating disorders, which are psychological, the mental health illnesses. What is the actual psychological impact then of these products and the advertising and the society that we live in? Is it damaging long term?
Yeah, I think what's really interesting when we kind of think about the psychological impact of kind of certain health products is that what the companies tend to do is they put a lot of research into the positive benefits and they never really look at the negative side of things. And I think that's why it can be quite difficult to get some research on this, because a lot of companies aren't wanting to know about the negatives of their products at all. And I guess this is where our friends over in kind of psychology are really helpful with these kind of questions and starting kind of being able to do a deep dive into this and really understanding that impact of these kind of dietary products or these almost like detox products as well. But what we do know and what we see a lot in clinic is that these diet products, these detox, this misinformation that's out there is having a huge impact upon people. And that's what we tend to see within clinic. And people are coming in and saying, I've been given so many external food rules from social media, from family members, from health professionals, that, and from people that you trust. And I think that's what's really difficult here, because these messages about nutrition and these food rules are coming from people that are in trusting positions. And what people have kind of explained and spoken to me about is that they've got these external food rules that they are ignoring their internal intuition around what their body needs and what their hunger signals are. So they're trying to basically override their natural body response.
It's really scary. And of course, that would then lead to a physical response. So once you start developing an eating disorder or you gain these food rules, what are some of the, I know this is a very big question and I'm asking for a smaller answer, but what are some of the physical impacts on health that you see?
And I think the biggest kind of physical impacts that we tend to see is because of all of these different fad diets, because of all of these different external rules that people have kind of following and putting a lot of time and energy and money into following. What we're kind of finding is that whole food groups are being missed. And there's so many, depending kind of on maybe different, say, juice cleansers or detoxers or certain diets or that people are doing, there's different physical kind of responses that the body has depending on what people have been following. But generally, we tend to see a deficit within certain nutrients. So, for example, if someone is doing a juice cleanse, for example, and eating much less of the kind of like solid foods, and they're having everything kind of as liquid, what we tend to find is that people are missing out on things like fiber. And if someone is missing out whole food groups, they might be missing kind of really important dairy sources. And what that then can lead to is people might develop these nutritional deficiencies that they hadn't even realized that they were missing out on key nutrients within their diets. And sometimes that can lead to really difficult gut symptoms. It can lead to things like low calcium content within the body, which can lead to osteopenia, osteoporosis. For some people, we might get energy and protein malnutrition as well. And for others, if they're not following kind of that a balanced diet and meeting all of their kind of nutritional needs, they might actually have some micronutrient deficiencies as well. So it's so important that people are getting the right advice so that they're not missing out on these really key nutrients that are so essential for their physical health.
100%. And then to go ahead and break this cycle and regain a happy, healthy relationship with food, how do you go about that within the clinic? Because again, all of these questions will be very big questions, which of course are all individual because every case is so unique. But on a general kind of day-to-day, how would you go about breaking this cycle?
So I think you're right in terms of everyone is so individual, and everyone has individual lives, and that's what's so important about kind of that one-to-one support, because there isn't one piece of advice that fits everyone, because everyone has different relationships with food. Mm-hmm. Everyone has different physical kind of maybe complications. People are wanting different kind of health outcomes. So what we need to think about first of all, the really important thing is for someone to step forward and say, I've got some difficulties and this is how it's affecting me. And that can be really hard for a lot of people to say that relationship with food that they've been struggling with has started to really impact upon the whole of their lives. So the first thing that I would always speak to people about and discuss is, how is this impacting you and how do you want things to be different? And supporting people to kind of be really honest with themselves, because if what they're saying is that this relationship might have been quite difficult for a while with their food choices, but more recently it's really starting to take over and have such a negative impact upon their lives, then we look at every part of their life to think, right, how is it impacting you and how do you want it to be a little bit better? And what we can then go on from there to do is think about, right, what education around nutrition do you already have? What do you know? What have you picked up from kind of social media, family and friends? If anything was ever discussed at school, college, university, and actually, where's that education come from? And is that the right information that people are getting? And sometimes what we can see within clinic is that people have very... sometimes they've got very set rules around food that maybe they've not even realised is affecting quite a lot of their lives. And we see it sometimes with kind of personal trainers sometimes, unfortunately, advising really high protein diets. Mm-hmm. And
everywhere,
Sarah, it's everywhere at the minute. And it's one of those things where you think, right, well, that's kind of what you've been advised, but let's look at what the research behind that is and let's make sure you've got that right information. And then what I tend to do is support people to say, okay, well, what do you think about that? We've got a bit of a contrast there. So what feels kind of maybe the right step for you? In terms of, is that something that you're wanting to continue to follow, or actually do we need to modify that a little bit? How is trying to reach that really high level of protein in your diet, how might that be affecting you physically, socially, psychologically as well? And then we start to challenge some of those thoughts, because food isn't just about physical health, it's about being able to be sociable with your friends, your family. And if you've got this food rule in your head telling you that you can and you can't have something, that can really impact upon whether you can go out for meals with friends, whether you can go and go to the cinema and get an ice cream. And there's so many aspects of someone's life that can really impact.
I just want to delve into who basically shouldn't be giving nutrition advice a little bit, because it can be very difficult for health professionals like Sarah, like myself, who it's very difficult to be heard with and not wanting any, because it's almost like a cult. I'm going to describe it like a kind of cult. It gets engagement, it sells, it makes money, people may see drastic results, but it doesn't mean it's good for your health. And they often cherry pick a lot of literature or studies and don't look at the wider board. And it's very, very concerning. People don't seem to be aware of their long-term health. It's just goals in the short term. And it does seem like anyway, I could go on about this protein thing for a very long time. But Sarah, I guess to answer my next question, why should people go to an eating disorder dietitian to work on an eating disorder?
Yeah. And I guess what I would kind of say to that is that actually, in terms of looking at the education that dietitians and and registered nutritionists have. We have studied nutrition and how that impacts upon physical health, psychological health, and your social health. We're looking at that behavior change. And I think that's why it's really important that we are looking at that person as a whole. And what we can find a lot from some health kind of gurus that aren't actually dietitians or nutritionists is what we tend to find is that they don't look at someone as an individual. They might look, like you've said, at one piece of research and say, oh, this research had good outcomes, everyone should do this. And they really push that one thing. But what we are the experts in doing is being able to know what that nutrition advice is, knowing how to support people to make changes that are their goals. They're not my goals, they're not someone else's goals, they're that individual's goals of what they want to be different, and thinking about how we can improve their overall health, their behavioral health, psychological health, their social health, their physical health. And in terms of the speciality of eating disorders, which we're trained and we train with a multidisciplinary team to understand what that eating disorder is and how it's affecting that person on an individual level. And we really take a lot of time to understand how it's impacting them in every part of their lives and how we can support someone individually to be able to improve things that person wants to improve. And when we're thinking about us being the experts, that's exactly what we are in terms of the experts within that nutrition. And but the people that are kind of coming into clinic and the clients that I work with are the experts within themselves. Yes. And having those two things kind of marry up within clinic and developing that relationship and us really understanding who that person is and who their values are and supporting them through what can be an extremely difficult path they're having to battle with their eating disorder thoughts and do lots of myth busting and trying different foods and managing anxieties and worries kind of around those foods if that's a goal that they have made. Whereas someone who isn't an expert in nutrition or who isn't an expert within eating disorders or hasn't trained in that area, their nutritional advice might not be accurate. They might not be qualified to give that advice. They might not be able to review all of that scientific literature to see kind of the pros and cons within the certain scientific literature to see whether that scientific literature is a good piece of research paper or whether actually it wasn't a great piece of research. And that there was maybe quite a lot of bias in that. And we look at information from lots of different sources. And what I would kind of recommend is if people are being given advice from professionals that don't work with people with kind of disordered eating or eating disorders, then I really would be recommending that you're finding someone that does, that's been going to be able to spend that time to understand who you are as a person, meet your goals and support you.
Thank you, Sarah. It's so important. You meant, and the blanket approach is just, it's because people make a lot of money from it on their apps, on their programs, they make a living from it, but they're not obviously aware of the consequences, or they don't care, quite to put it blankly, they don't care. Even if it might appear like they do, they're all showmen or showwomen, if we look at it that way, sometimes to make a living. Right, we do have lots of questions from our listeners. And the first one is from Louisa, and she has said, what exactly does a normal relationship with food look like? I don't understand, everyone harps on about moderation, which I think is quite a valid question.
Yeah, and I think that there's such different kind of compartments really to what is a normal relationship with food. And it can be a really difficult concept and something to define, because what's normal for one person is maybe not normal to someone else. And I think that what I tend to kind of think about with the clients that I work with is think about what were things like before maybe this disordered relationship with food happened. What were you able to do? And generally what kind of people tend to say is, okay, well, that normal eating for them is that you're able to eat what you need, what you fancy, what you're kind of wanting to have on whichever day that you're wanting to have that, that you're not governed by any specific food rules. Mm-hmm. And that if you fancy eating something, that you can go and have that and there's nothing stopping you, or there's no guilt or shame or worry around that, that you're able to go and spontaneously eat something. If you walk past a takeaway, for example, you know that actually, do you know what, I can smell that takeaway, maybe I want to have a takeaway tonight. And you're basically saying, my internal kind of hunger, my internal needs, I'm listening to those and I'm responding to them, and I'm not responding to external kind of food rules or social media or what people are telling me that I should be doing. So that normal eating is very individual to kind of everyone, and it also impacts upon what your social norm is in kind of your culture as well, because people will have different social norms around eating in different cultures. So we need to take that into account as well. But it's very much about honouring that appetite and responding to it, honouring the fact that if your body's hungry, having something that you want to have, not feeling like you are restricted in any way.
Yes, exactly, because restriction is not the one. And it leads me nicely on to a question from Diana, who said, calories on menus scare me. I don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I bet you've had a lot of this in the clinic.
Yes, we've had quite a lot. And I think especially in terms of the new government guidance that's coming out about putting calories onto menus. Mm. And there's lots of pros, there's lots of cons to it. But I think one of the things that's really difficult is that if we're just putting calories on food, then what we're doing is we're focusing that food means that number that's on there, when actually food means so much more than just a number. There's so many other nutrients in there. But also when we're going out for meals, we're going out for meals to be sociable, we're going out for meals to enjoy our foods, we're going out for meals for the fun that is involved within that. And we're not going out for a meal to actually have a little look to see the calorie content that's within something and what that number even means. And it's a number. And actually we need to have energy because that's what fuels our body. And everyone will need certain amounts. So even by putting kind of those numbers on a menu, it doesn't really mean much because everyone's so individual. And I just wish that there was kind of an option to almost have a menu with calories on for those people that it might help, but then to have a menu that doesn't have any of that information on so that people can just go out and enjoy.
Yeah, I did I can't remember what it was. I was on a debate on, I think it's Five Live. I was on the radio, put on the spot about this subject on calories. Yeah. And the opposition said to me, well, what they've said is that you can ask for a menu without calories on it if you want, but that's not the point. And I actually don't think it's fair, because if you look at it, like you said, we know calories aren't that simple. We know it's way more about the quality of the food and the nutrient. And most people are already aware of calories in food. It's probably not going to make a huge difference. And then you boil down to the fact that it's always penalizing the minority who are in society. For instance, if you are disadvantaged in society and accessibility, there's all these types of things. And it's almost the same when it comes to food, because if you have a mental health illness, once again, you are discriminated for that and you're not counted. You know, the majority always wins. Yeah. And I just feel it's really sad.
I absolutely agree. And actually, when you look at the research and you look into, did these calories on menus make a difference? Mm. It's There's not actually a lot of evidence there, unfortunately. And I think I would absolutely agree with you, because they're doing something to help maybe a certain number of kind of people. And it's kind of that public health message. But actually, why can't we be having the menus don't have the calories on, and that if you want to have that information, then you ask for it and do it that way around, because actually some of that research just isn't quite there to say that it does even make an impact for people when they're wanting to change the options that they're having. But what we do know is that it has a huge impact on people that have disordered eating or eating disorders, and it can really influence their whole day and influence their food choices, which is not what eating is about.
No, exactly. Numbers. Thank you. Yeah. Yes. I've got time for one more question, but that was a really good discussion on that. I'm glad we covered that topic.
Absolutely.
So we've got Isabel, who said, I'm worried that my best friend has an eating disorder. She isn't eating enough. I don't know how to help her. And I think it's really difficult for an onlooker who's watching somebody that you think has a disordered relationship with food. It's very difficult, isn't it? How do you go about it?
Yeah, and I think you're right. I think it's really tough, and it's really hard for someone to see someone struggling, but maybe that person themselves not realizing that they're struggling as much as they are. And I think it's, you sound like a brilliant friend that's been able to kind of identify that someone's going through a really tough time at the moment. And I think that what's really important is that you as a friend are there to support them and listen to them and not be judgmental, not kind of telling them that they need to do this, that and the other, but just being there as a listening ear to kind of find out what's going on, be a little bit curious, figure out how it's maybe impacting upon them, what they think about what's happening, and offering that support to say, thank you for sharing that with me. And if you ever feel that maybe you want to talk to someone about it, I'm here, but maybe we can get some support from a professional and I can help you with that and speak to you about how we can go to someone and get some support. Because it takes a lot of bravery for someone to say, I'm struggling and I need some support. But having a friend or having someone just open up that question just really kindly and open up that conversation and just checking in with someone can make a huge, huge difference. And there's a
and
lot
is it
of charity.
Important, Sarah, just to add, no, yeah. It's my fault, because I just think we need to get this clarification from you. If someone isn't ready, is it a wise idea to push it if they don't take kindly?
It's a really difficult kind of discussion to have, because the thing is, if someone's not ready, what it can do is, if you keep pushing and pushing, what it can do is it can strengthen that eating disorder. But at the same time, if someone's really struggling, if they don't get support early, then that eating disorder can become a lot more entrenched and more difficult to kind of recover from. And what we know is that early intervention is the absolute key to recovery. And so it puts people in very, very difficult situations. So I would always be kind of encouraging someone who's struggling to go to the doctor, to seek help, to speak to. There's lots of online services. There's lots of charities that are out there that you can speak to someone about. But never just leave it as a friend, because if you are really worried and they're not taking on your advice, thinking, right, is there someone else that we can speak to about that? And GPs are your key person to be able to get kind of that further support.
Yeah, 100%. Thank you so much, Sarah. We're going to move on now to something a bit more lighthearted but equally important, which is our fact or fiction round. It's very difficult to do this for eating disorders, I will say. So I hope they come across in the right way. Are you ready?
Oh, I'm a bit worried about this, but yeah, let's do it.
Let's see what happens. Okay, here we go. Exercising daily increases your appetite.
Do you know what? I can't say fact or fiction to this. Is that really bad?
It's not bad at all. Go on, go for it.
I think the thing is, what we kind of... Can I do an explanation or not?
Yeah, go yeah. for it. That's what it's
so,
for.
Yeah, I think, I guess what we know in terms of when people exercise, that their body needs to have more fuel and they need to have more nutrition. So in some ways, it may well increase your appetite. But actually, if someone's kind of maybe a low weight, or if someone is has a troubled relationship with activity, I wouldn't be recommending them to exercise to feel hungry. So sorry, that one's not a fact or a fiction.
That's good. Here we go. Juicing is healthier than blending.
Juicing is healthier than blending. I think I would say false, so fiction with that one, because the problem is it's that fiber content that you've kind of got there.
Eggs should be limited because of their cholesterol content.
Fiction.
Skipping breakfast increases risk of weight gain.
Oh, fiction.
Do you want to expand on that?
Yeah, so breakfast is a really strange one in the sense that breakfast is so important. However, some people just don't like breakfast. But what we know in terms of the research is that having regular meals throughout the day actually helps you to kind of maintain a kind of a, I don't like the word healthy, but I'm going to have to use it.
I know.
A healthy body weight. I really don't like the word healthy at all.
It's hard, isn't it? I think everything now, though, has become very difficult. Language on a whole, the words we can pick, I struggle with this as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So in terms of having regular meals, that's really helpful from a nutrition point of view, because certain foods will be absorbed kind of better in smaller amounts throughout the day. So and I think that in terms of thinking about having a regular intake, we're better off having sort of your regular kind of carbohydrates throughout the day. And there's so much in that. So if you're not having breakfast, it means that you may be having a little bit more later on in the day, which is absolutely fine. But it's then just thinking about, well, why am I skipping breakfast? So am I skipping breakfast because I'm worried, I'm scared, or is it just something that you don't like and that you've never done? Sorry, that was really long-winded.
No, not at all. Do not apologise. We want you on the podcast for your knowledge. Here we go. Legumes must be eaten at the same time as grains to get a complete protein.
Ooh, so this is a fact and a fiction.
Yeah.
Because certain certain kind of foods together will help you to meet all of your essential amino acids. So they're kind of the essential amino acids are basically your building blocks of protein. So if you eat certain foods together, then it may well help you to meet all of those essential amino acids that you can only get from food and not make. However, if you're having a varied diet throughout the day, the chances are you're probably meeting what you need. So we don't necessarily need to kind of think about, I must have these two things together all of the time.
Brilliant. Always combating a food rule. I love it. fat-free and low-fat foods are always better than full fat.
Ooh. Can I say fact and fiction for this
one? Yeah, you can indeed.
100%. I'll explain myself.
Yeah.
So the reason for that is obviously people have different medical conditions. And for some people, it may well be that they need to, for their medical condition, may need to follow a lower sugar diet. For other people, they may need to have a slightly higher fat diet. But there's nothing wrong with either of those things. And it's that word moderation again. There's nothing wrong with having things in moderation. It's just that some foods might be developed and might be better for some people with certain medical conditions compared to other people. So it's all about thinking, what are your physical, social, psychological kind of needs around food. And if you're scared or worried about having fat within your diet, having a low fat yogurt isn't going to be helpful, and that actually you need to be having a full fat yogurt to be able to combat that fear.
Why you see clients in clinic. This is why dietitians and nutritionists are qualified. That's it. The fewer carbs you eat, the healthier you are.
False. So that's fiction. Yeah.
Yeah. You are more likely to be slimmer on a plant-based diet.
Fiction.
Every plant-based eater should supplement with a multivitamin.
That is fact, because there's certain nutrients that if you're plant-based, that you're less likely to be able to kind of get within your diet. So it is important that you are supplementing. It doesn't have to be kind of like an A to Z multivitamin, but just being aware, depending which foods you are having, that you might be missing out on certain nutrients. However, you can have a very well-planned plant-based diet that meets all of your nutritional needs. So yeah, I guess that's a bit of fact and fiction, actually, isn't it?
I love it. Sarah, did you know that was a brilliant fact or fiction round and so informative. It just reinserts exactly why you are doing the job you are doing and why everyone in the Retrition Clinic that sees you is so lucky to have you. I was just going, yes, yes, every time you were speaking, and in such a wonderful way too. It does wrap up the episode, but with every guest, we finish with a food for thought. And I think mine today, to start, would be that nothing is black and white. And be very careful, as I always say, who you go to for nutritional information. But I know that a lot of the time, us health professionals may not be giving out wonderfully interesting information. But that's because we're so aware of the nuances and we're so aware of the unique situation everybody has. And I can see how people may get frustrated, like the question we had on, what is moderation? You know, what does it even look like? And you just want an answer. We completely understand, but we'd need an hour in clinic with you at least to have address your personal diets. But ultimately, hopefully, if anybody is struggling and they're listening to this episode, there is help out there. And I'm sure that Sarah, when she gives her nugget of information in a minute, will be able to direct you to some wonderful resources.
Yeah, that's such a good food for thought. And I think you're totally right. Everything is so individual. And yeah, there isn't any set answer because everyone is so, so individual, definitely.
I mean, what would be your, if you could give one food for thought for people today, and then we can give some resources, what would that be?
I think, I guess my food for thought is thinking about the people that are out there that may well be struggling with disordered eating or eating disorders, and just to say that you are being really brave kind of coming forward and asking for support and acknowledging that maybe this is affecting you, and you must be battling with so many difficult thoughts and emotions. And the people that I work with in clinic are just so amazing if being able to kind of say, do you know what, I need some support, I need some help, and put in such a lot of hard work to be able to change that relationship with food and regain the control of their lives and have that much better relationship with food over time. And I think that it's possible to do. And I've been working with people with disordered eating and eating disorders for, it'll be around about 10 years, I think, in October. And I've seen so many people that have said, I don't think this is possible. And they have had an amazing recovery. And I just want to kind of say, if you are suffering, if you are finding things really difficult, that recovery is possible. And just getting the right people around you in your team to support you through that is so, so important.
Wow. I mean, Sarah, lovely to finish on a high. I actually think for a topic that is obviously extremely difficult, you've navigated it with a very positive outlook, which is really appreciated. So where can you send people to get more help, and how can they learn more about what you do?
So obviously I'm working at the Retrition Clinic, so there's loads of resources on Rhiannon's website, but also there's lots of charities out there as well. Yes. If you are suffering, if you are finding things really difficult and you want to have a chat with someone, I know that there's obviously the Beat website that you can go to, and you can speak with someone on one of the helplines there, but your GP as well will be able to support you and speak to the people that are in your lives as well. And say to them, I need some support, and can you help me with this? And if you need some more information, and think about, okay, how is this affecting me? What support can I get? The Beat website is absolutely brilliant in terms of being able to give you those free resources and even information to take to your GP to say, This is what an eating disorder is, and this is the support that I need. And also getting the right support from the right people in terms of your registered nutritionist and your registered dietitians that work with people that have been through similar difficulties to yourselves.
Oh, Sarah, thank you so, so much. And thank you for coming on Food for Thought today.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you are enjoying Food for Thought, you are going to absolutely love our up and coming episodes. So if you don't already, make sure you're subscribed. That way you will be the first to hear it every Monday. It would also be brilliant if you have the time to leave a review. These reviews are so crucial to make sure that we can reach more people and of course reach those higher highs in the charts. For more information about my nutrition clinic, the books, healthy recipes and so much more, please visit nutrition.com. You can follow me at nutrition on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, TikTok and YouTube. And of course, don't forget The Science of Nutrition, my latest book, will be out December the 30th, 2021.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.